You know, I live in constant fear that my phone will be the one to go off, so I'm turning that off now. Greetings again and welcome to Christ the King. We've started this series over the last, just last week, on the Apostles' Creed, an ancient confession of the church delivered to us from thousands of years ago. And last week we sort of made the argument that the Apostles' Creed is the best of all possible creeds, all possible belief systems, because it alone roots you in something that is true and enduring, but also that fills you with life and joy. In the midst of the marketplace of the creeds, the Apostles' Creed stands alone. I don't know if you noticed walking in, we did a little visual thing up here to kind of represent this. I asked Claire to tape up the two creeds that we used last week as illustrations on either side sort of the sign here. She said she put that one up, and then she realized that she only had that one up. She's like, quick, got to get the other one up before we become that kind of church or whatever, you know. And what's interesting about the visual symbolism here, I think, is important. That in this room and in this community and in the church generally, maybe you or some, if not you, somebody else in these pews probably more closely identifies with one or other of these signs. Are you aware of that? Please don't start shooting each other. You know, like, it's not clear. You're going to at least have to take some time to figure out who is who. But what we're kind of saying with the Apostles' Creed is this, that whether emotionally you resonate with one of these creeds or the other more, what is central to us and to our identity as Christians is the Apostles' Creed. That's what sits in the middle right there. But more than that, it's what sits up there in judgment over all earthly creeds and beliefs that men and women would profess. I wonder, for you, which part of the Apostles' Creed, sitting in judgment over these creeds, would be the most difficult for you to say? What is the hardest thing, the hardest part about the Apostles' Creed to say? If you don't know the Apostles' Creed, that's totally fine. We'll say it here in a minute. You can just turn a page and maybe look at it if you need to know, but which part of the Apostles' Creed is the biggest stumbling block for you? Is it the part about God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth? Ooh, that's a tough one. We'll get to that in a couple weeks. Really? God made it? Is it the fact that Jesus Christ was his son who was conceived by the Holy Ghost and born of a virgin? Man, as you listed out, there's clearly some stumbling blocks to modern ears in this thing. Is it the Holy Spirit? We don't believe in the Spirit anymore, do we? We believe in what we can taste and see and touch and feel. I wonder if those are the hardest parts of the creed for you to get over. Or what I'm going to suggest to you actually today is this. That the hardest part of the creed to say is the part that I skipped over when I was listening, all the hardest parts. It's the word that comes right there at the beginning. It's the word I. That, I think, is one of the hardest parts of the Apostles' Creed to say. Not just because it's the Apostles' Creed that makes it difficult to say I, but actually because saying I is really hard, period, for us as human beings. I scrolled back through some old text messages to confirm this theory of mine that I was working on this week while preparing for this sermon. I scrolled through some old text messages. Some of it was with text with some of you. Some of it was from my previous job working with college students at Savannah College of Art and Design. And anytime I had to say something really kind of risky and vulnerable, I always cut out the word I always cut it out. There was a conversation that I had with a student that was really difficult. One of her parents had died, and she was texting me about this, and I asked if she wanted to talk on the phone. She said she wasn't ready to do that yet, so we were texting about this, and I found myself saying this: care about you, here for you, God loves you. And it was funny. It was really easy to say God. It was really easy. But I couldn't say I. It was hard to say I care about you. It was hard to say I'm here for you. Do you feel the difference, even as I say those words, between care about you and I care about you, that's a big difference. To say I is to put your personhood at stake. It's risky. If you tell somebody I love you and they reject it, they haven't just rejected the concept of love. They haven't just rejected your relationship. They've rejected you. They've rejected I. I is the hardest thing for all of us to say because it's risky and because it's deeply vulnerable. Ironically, this is actually true in all the commentators who talk about the Apostles' Creed. They always start every single... I'm totally alone in this sermon, y'all, so y'all better give me some credit. I had no help from anybody. Because you know what everybody does when they start writing commentaries on the Apostles' Creed is their first chapter inevitably begins, I believe in. And what do you think they spend all their time talking about in those chapters? Belief. And what belief is. And nobody talks about I. Nobody asks questions of identity and personhood and risk and vulnerability. Nobody asks that question because it's hard and because we just want to assume it and we want to get on to talking about anything else other than what's going on like in here. We're really good at dodging and not saying I. And I would have been totally alone in preparing the sermon unless it weren't for old JC. You know what I'm talking about, right? John Calvin. He says this. Stodgy, angry. Maybe you have background with Presbyterianism, and that's fine. I'm not trying to make you be a Presbyterian. I just want you to be a Christian, all right? But John Calvin, if he has an insight to contribute, it is in the opening lines of his book, Calvin's Institutes. When he says this, forget everything else you think you know about him and hear me. Human wisdom, insofar as it ought to be deemed true and solid wisdom, consists almost entirely of two parts, the knowledge of God and the knowledge of ourselves. But these are connected together by many ties. It is not easy to determine which of the two precedes and gives birth to the other. Well, it wasn't just John Calvin saying that, of course. It was Jesus Christ as well. And that's what he's all about in the text that we've read. This question of our identity, this question of I, this question of who we are and what's going on in here, deep down in here. Now, there are 10,000 different sermons you could give on identity, and you've probably heard at this point in time about 9,000 of them. So I'm just going to focus on a couple of identity issues that come up in Matthew 16, verse 13. And in particular, I'm going to try to poke a little bit at those of us who grew up in religious context, who really value obedience and conformity. I'm going to take a shot at you first. And then we're going to get to the world, and we're going to talk about some of the ways in which the world constructs the I. The world constructs its identity, and we'll have some things to say there as well. And lastly, what I'm going to try to do every time we talk about this, so that we're not just talking dry theologies, instead say why the Apostles' Creed gives you the most hope of life and joy in this life and in the life to come. So first we'll say this. If we are followers of Christ, we must learn to say I, because Jesus is always poking it and provoking it. Did you see there in verse 13, Jesus shows up in this district. He's asking the guys, following him around. And he asks them this really generic question up front, right? Or at least that's how the apostles or the disciples take it. Who do people out there say that I am, the Son of Man is? And they know, of course, that he's using this term, which he frequently used to refer to himself. And the apostles do what those of us who grew up in church always do when somebody asks us to give an answer to a question, right? Because we know the right answers, and we know all the theological stipulations that go along with those things. And so that's what we're comfortable and safe dishing out. Either theology, facts about God, right? Or the right answer, moral facts about how to behave. We know how to do this. In some ways, I'm going to make a massive generalization here. If this doesn't apply to you, that's fine. Don't hate me. Just move right along. It's sort of a typical male response. Let's be honest. I'm picking on myself here. Hiding behind theory and hiding behind analysis, as opposed to really risking any deep and substantial self disclosure. They answer, well, some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. It's all impersonal. It's all analysis. This is the moment when your spouse comes home and tells you about their day and you just spend all your time telling them what they could have done differently. You know, note to you guys, doesn't work, okay? That's not what she's asking for, is it? She's not asking for your analysis about what she did wrong that day and how her day could have gone different. No, she's asking for you to show up and listen to her. She's asking for some empathy. She's asking for some risk. And that's what Jesus is doing here. Who do people say that I am? And they spit out some theology. They spit out all the biblically correct answers, you know, that they learned in synagogue school or Saturday school or whatever they called it. And Jesus doesn't let it rest. He goes beyond that. And it comes out more in the Greek than it does in your English, so I've got to be a Greek nerd now. Verse 15 is really this. Jesus says to them, but you, who do you say that I am? And there's this emphasis, this repetition on the you. Jesus is not sitting there. He is not content with our theological right and wrong. And he is not content with us showing up as behavioral conformists to church on Sunday, nice and clean. No, he wants something radically different, radically more, radically less passive, radically more risky, radically more vulnerable. He wants not our thoughts, not our theories, not our opinions. He wants us. He wants us. He wants you to say, I. The tragedy of Christianity right now, I think, is that we have baptized this sort of passivity. We've rewarded people who come up with the right answers or have the right theology. We've baptized it. Here's a quote from a famous preacher that maybe you have read, maybe you haven't, Martin Lloyd-Jones, says something like this. And I want you to listen and put on the ear that is Jesus's, the ear that demands some sense of personal risk. This preacher says, my dear friends, if we only spent more of our time looking at Jesus, we'd soon forget ourselves. And Jesus sits there and says, that's too passive for me. I don't want you to forget yourself. In fact, I'm burrowing into your story. I'm going to figure out not just what you think, but who you are. Who you are. He pushes past our abstractions and makes it personal. He pokes us in the chest, and he's still doing that today. Sometimes those moments are explicit, and sometimes they're implicit. Wearing this thing around all day, I get poked in the chest about who I am on the basis of who Jesus is fairly regularly. I've told some of you this story, but it bears repeating. One time I was preaching a sermon at a small little country church in the middle of Georgia, and I used an illustration about Martin Luther King Jr., and I used it positively because that was the illustration. Good guy, right? There's like probably 10, 15 people out there. And after the service, I'm packing up, getting ready to go. And, kind of gathering my notes and stuff and get back on the road to come here. When this guy comes charging up, short, older man. And he gets right next to me, right here. And he pokes me in the chest. And he says something like, I hate him, but you ignore him. Who's worse? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I just have no idea. I mean, it's been a while. We've done a lot of stuff in the sermon. It's like, but this guy's being really aggressive, and I'm getting a little nervous that I can see the elders of the church start walking forward like they're going to have to get in between us or something. And then I realize, like, oh, he's talking about black people. That's what he's saying. And he goes on this tirade about how I came down from the big city to tell him how to live from my big house with my swimming pool to kind of push him around. And I was like, bro, if you had any idea, you know, I live on 33rd Street in Savannah. It's like, there ain't no swimming pool, I'll tell you that. I promise you. But he was poking me in the chest. And like, I don't know, what do you do? What would you do in that moment where you're forced to say, is this what I really believe? Or am I going to acquiesce to the aggression in order to make peace? Now, a better pastor might have said, like, I'll pray for you or something. I just slapped his hand and told him not to touch me anymore. And then the elders kind of grabbed him and walked him out of the church. It comes up explicitly for some of us, right? That's an extreme story. And in my line of work, Jesus is always kind of asking me, who are you? But my suspicion is that for many of you, it comes up far more implicitly. In all of these little moments throughout the day, Jesus is asking you to make decisions, to show yourself, to show up, to be risky and to be vulnerable, and to say, I want, I need, I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm mad, I'm glad. Here's another more implicit example, and then we'll move on from this. I was in a group sort of counseling setting in seminary, and I was sitting there telling some stories like you do in these sorts of settings about moments of shame in my life. This particular story was a time when I got picked on in middle school for my name. And my counselor looked at me and he said, when they were picking on you about your name, how did that make you feel? And so I said, what were the teachers doing? And he said, yeah, they should have been there. But Soren, when they were picking on you, how did that make you feel? And I said, well, the bullies were just kids. They didn't know any better. And the counselor stands up and he walks over to this blackboard. And on it he writes, mad, sad, glad. And then he says, Soren, when the kids were picking on you, how did that make you feel? I said, oh, finally I got there. I felt sad. It was very hard. But I had not realized how much I had hidden behind my analysis, my theorizing, my complaints about the world, and just failed to show up as a human being. And I think what Jesus is telling Peter and the disciples here, and what he's telling us here today, is this. Jesus wants that person. He doesn't want the person with the right answers, of the abstractions, or the prescriptions for behavior to make your life go better. Jesus wants the person who can say, I am sad. I am mad. I am glad. Read the Psalms thinking that that's what Jesus wants, and they will start to make sense to you. Because you don't find many answers in the Psalms. You don't find many theories. You find people saying, I am mad, I am sad, and I am glad. Maybe if we could learn to say I in the small things with people who already know us, we would be ready to say I in the big things with people who disagree with us. The Apostles' Creed, when it says I, it doesn't want conformity. It doesn't want you to mumble it because everybody else is mumbling it. It wants authenticity. It starts with I, not with we or with they. And here's what I'm saying. I think Jesus is saying it here. Jesus will wreck your world to teach you to say I. He will destroy all the pious phrases that we're using to hide from reality and from ourselves. He is relentless. He will poke you in the chest. I think many of our tragedies and sufferings in this life that we are so mad about and complaining about are actually Jesus poking us in the chest. Who are you? And who am I? So how do we start to answer that question? These next 2 points are much shorter, I promise you. How do we answer the question, who am I? How might you begin to start saying that and answering that question more holistically? I'm going to say this. How does our world suggest that we ought to answer the question, who am I? Our world provides a process by which you might begin to discover your identity. And I think you're familiar with the basic contours and shapes of this process. The world says, look deep inside yourself to find the you that's really there, and then express it out into the world. That's why all of us are taking all of these personality quests tests on the internet. Myers-Briggs, Enneagram, what character in Star Wars or Ted Lasso are you? We can't stop clicking on these things because we think that buried deep down inside of us somewhere is this I, this self, and that if we can find that self, then ultimately what we're trying to do is just push it out into the world. To overcome all the resistance and oppression that the world might put on it, right? We think that how we feel is who we are And this ultimately, I think, gives rise to all the liberation narratives from Christianity. You know, the sorts of people who grew up in Christian contexts whereby Christianity was really about conformity, where they were never listened to, like Jesus is trying to listen to the disciples, but instead were forced to conform. They never got to say, I, and so eventually they have this long screed on Instagram about how they're leaving the repressive, angry church. There's something to that, y'all. There's something to that. We need to listen. But I think we need to recognize that there is something in this method of looking deep inside yourself that's actually true. Something to it, right? That there are parts of ourselves that don't fit well in the world, and that part of what we need to do is learn how to be okay with that and comfortable with that and bring it out. That's not all wrong. But I think there are some problems, and I think Jesus gets at them here. When we look deep down inside of ourselves to figure out who we are, who I am, if you will, we realize something very quickly, if we're being honest. That in here is this confused being who wants and feels a ton of different things all the time. I look inside myself and sometimes I think I want the most beautiful good things there are. And other times I realize that, man, I just want to smash some stuff. Like, both of those things are going on inside of me all the time. So the question is, if I'm looking down in here without any outside help, how am I going to figure out which one of those things is the true me? Which one? When I was a little kid, I was on a walk with my mom and we saw this caterpillar on the ground. I was probably about 4 years old. This might be my earliest memory, which, if there are any therapists out there, and I know that there are, we're going to have fun unpacking after the sermon, I promise you. This sort of example of the multiple people inside one of us. We're stopping to just look at this caterpillar. My mom was telling me, look, it's beautiful. Isn't it furry? How many legs does it have? Can you count it? Wow. Did you know? I'll let you in on a secret. Y'all aren't going to believe this, I'll tell you. Caterpillars go into cocoons and become butterflies. Can you believe that? It's amazing. As a little kid, I was much more willing to be amazed than all of you cynical grown-ups are right now. Wow. As we turn to walk away, my mom turns to walk away, she hears something like this. Splat. She turns around, and I've stepped on the thing. And she named me. She said, Soren, what did you do? These are moments that Christians are made, right? I said, through tears, the devil made me do it. I wasn't as wrong as you think I am, but I wasn't all right either. The reality is that within me, there was something who could admire a caterpillar, and there was something who could crush it. And the question is, which one of those me's ought to come out? The other reality is this, that who you are is always going to change based on who's around you. I know this is countercultural to say. We think, again, that who I am is something deep down in here that is always the same. But the reality is who you are is always changing, always transforming. There was a story out of Paris a few years ago about some guys who came in to rob the McDonald's. And they came busting in and they said, this is a stick up. I'm in charge. Except they said it in French, right? I am in charge. That's who I am. Hear it carefully. What they didn't know is that there were 11 members of France's most elite counterterrorism force, fully armed, in combat fatigue, sitting in the back of that McDonald's. And so as soon as they said, I'm in charge, a bunch of these big, intimidating guys stood up and said, you are not in charge. We are in charge. And the relationships fundamentally changed, and everybody's identity went all topsy-turvy, confused. And that's actually true for all of us as well, isn't it? Who I am, man, it changes. It changes all the time. That's part of the reason I wear this. It's like, I want some stability, you know. I want to be something stable, both for you guys and in my role. So here's what I'm saying. I think Jesus in this text gives us a better way of figuring out who we are. A better way. He says that our identity is not found by looking inside of us and then trying to bring that thing out. But that our ultimate identity is found in relationship to Jesus. Jesus says to them, verse 15, but who do you say that I am? He asks, but you, who do you say that I am? See, it's like for them to be a full person, for them to be complete, They're going to have to define themselves in relationship to Jesus. And what he says ultimately is that your identity, who you really are, only flourishes and comes to fulfillment as you get to know him. Did you see it there in 17 and 18? Peter's name is Peter. That's his name. But Jesus says that Peter is not just a name, it's also a metaphor that hits at the essence of who Peter is. Peter means rock. And Jesus says, you are Peter, and on this rock you will build my church. See, I will build my church. And there's something about Peter as he confesses Jesus Christ as Lord that makes Peter not less Peter, but more Peter. He becomes more fully himself as he bends the knee to Jesus. That's how it works. The God who made you knows you better than you know yourself. He knows what you might become if you will follow him better than you know yourself. And Jesus is in the process of doing exactly what Michelangelo did with the statue of David. You know the statue of David, the most famous Renaissance statue of all. Somebody asked the great master, how did you make him? And Michelangelo says, I looked at the stone and I chipped away everything that wasn't him. And David came out. And what I think Jesus is doing in us now, as we confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, he's looking at the stone of you and who you are. And he's chipping away everything that isn't you. There was more stone before, but you become more defined. This is way better. It's rooted in the transcendent. Verse 17 makes that clear. Not flesh and blood, but my Father who is in heaven. That's an identity that's rooted not in the changeable circumstances of our current chaotic world, but actually in heaven where things do not change. It's more stable because your feelings and your identities change, but Jesus doesn't. It's like a rock, verse 18. And it's more powerful. It's going to conquer. This identity will last forever, even through death, because it's yoked into the one, Jesus himself, who conquered death. It's more true, it's more stable, and more powerful. But the best part about finding an identity based on who Jesus is and who he calls you to be is that it gives you something exciting to live for now. We'll close with this. Jesus purposes the I. See, the biggest tragedy about our modern conception of how we become ourselves is that it ultimately leaves us desperately alone. It leaves us desperately alone. Because as you look inside for yourself, for who you are, and you attempt to express that out into the world is reduced down to an obstacle to your self-expression or something that helps you express yourself. It either affirms you or it's a bigot. Those are the only two options. And it's actually, on some level, it's deeply solipsistic. It's like, all we can ever ask is, how am I doing? And we never get to ask this question, what am I for? What am I for? Everything is for us, and we aren't for anything. And that attitude, we hate in everything except ourselves. My favorite TV show of all time, I'm on a fifth time watching it right now. Fifth time. Emma would laugh if she were in here. Fifth time this year. Firefly, maybe you know the show. It's about a raggedy ship and a ragtag crew, each of whom has a very unique identity. Each of whom has a very unique identity. There's Kaylee, the genius mechanic girl, who's almost an engine whisperer. There's Zoe, the first mate, always a cool head. There's a doctor who's also a refugee. There's Jane, the biggest, strongest weapons expert in the whole group. There's even a mysterious preacher with skills in combat. Where did he get those? There's Inara, a working girl, if you know what I mean. The captain, the one who gives the orders. And these roles and these orders and these identities are not what make the crew, are not a problem for the crew of this ship. They're not identities that are there to be escaped or transcended. No. They're the only thing that makes the show worth watching. Their roles, their unique identities, come together to keep this ragtag ship in the skies. It's the only thing that really makes it interesting is when we join our eyes to the crew, bringing our unique voices to the confession. That is actually how we do what Jesus says Peter will do. Build my church. You have been given a mission which encompasses your identity and transcends it. This is how identity becomes destiny. A purpose that you would suffer for, that you would give up your own happiness to see accomplished. This is what makes the Christian life the greatest adventure of all, that it is not all in the final instance about you. The Apostles' Creed is true, but this is why it's beautiful. It gives you a destiny and purpose that transcends your own life. And in so doing, enables you to be happy even unto death and in the resurrection beyond. Who are you? You. Can you define that identity not just by looking at yourself, although we must, but also looking at Jesus? It's only there we get a sense of meaning. This is going to be hard. It's going to be risky work. To say I is a vulnerable thing. Let's ask for help in doing it. Dear Jesus, would you help us to get to know ourselves? Would you protect us from the impulse towards simple conformity, towards pushing you off with information about you instead of communion with you? Jesus, will you keep us from defining ourselves simply by our own desires, but ultimately by who you are, by your rule and reign as King? Jesus, will you help us join our voice to the chorus of the saints throughout the ages who've confessed that you truly are our Lord? We ask this in your name. Amen.